Welcome to Signature Books Podcast. I'm Beth Brummer-Reeve, Marketing Specialist for Signature Books. Signature Books is a proud member of the Dialogue Podcast Network. My guest today is author Richard D. Hanks. His book, To Be a Friend to Christ, The Life of Marian D. Hanks, just released. Richard D. Hanks is an author and retired senior business executive, having served at several of the largest multinational companies in the world, including Marriott, PepsiCo, and Price Waterhouse. Also a successful serial entrepreneur, he was named by Ernst & Young as Entrepreneur of the Year in 2010. Rich obtained his bachelor's degree from Brigham Young University and his MBA from Northwestern University, and taught as an adjunct professor at Cornell for 10 years. He has served as a board director of profit and nonprofit organizations and as an in-demand public speaker and well-regarded lecturer at many universities. Rich and his wife, Liz, raised their family in Texas, Maryland, and Utah, and now reside in Salt Lake City. He is active in his faith, having served as a missionary in Scotland, a youth leader, a bishop, and a mission president in Alabama. Rich loves being with his family and in his spare time enjoys sports and woodworking. He adores his wife, Liz, loves their three terrific children and their spouses, and spoils his 11 grandchildren. Welcome, Richard, and thank you for being on our podcast today.
Thank you for inviting me, Beth.
Richard, to begin with, writing a biography is such a monumental undertaking, and you wrote a biography of your dad. What made you decide to do this?
I like pain. that's a great question. I guess the short answer is I loved my dad. And I'm not sure that a large number of the current membership of the church really got to know him. There is, I think I talked about this in the preface, there's a little bit of starry-eyed son, but I did my best to be objective. And, I consider myself an active Latter-day Saint, but I'm a thinker. And I know he was that way in spades. I mean, he just was fabulous in my opinion as a member of the church, obviously as his son. But the first audience was I just wanted to be able to do it for him. My grandchildren, I'd like my grandchildren and their children to know about him. And I guess the third big grouping of people is I kind of hope that there are members of the church that could really benefit. He was different. He was unusual. He wasn't in the cookie cutter general authority mode or mold at all. And I think he served while he was alive as a beacon to a lot of people that were not just so in the church, that may be a little bit on the edges or had questions or had faith crises, or we didn't call it that back then. I don't see the word faith crises in his journals, but that's what we call it now. And he was overwhelmed by people. So I kind of hope that maybe even, my wife and I got to be mission presidents. I'd like to have our missionaries learn a little bit about what things may have been like. We look backwards in time and try to figure stuff out, but it's not in context. It's not exactly the same thing. So I'm hoping that there will be some hope, some faith for others who may struggle.
I think that comes out through the book, and a couple of the things I really liked learning about his early life. And, his father passed away when he was only 2 years old. And there's a story that I just want to quote a little bit from. It's when Marian is going to serve a mission, and he, in preparation, marches down to a clothing store holding tightly to five $20 bills, and they're wadded together in his pocket. The $100 represented a new suit and overcoat that he would wear on his mission. He was startled when a man stepped in front of him and stretched out his hand. It was Anthon Ulrich, an old friend of Duff's father and a fellow church member. When Ulrich asked where Duff was headed, he replied that he was going on a mission and he was on his way to buy a suit. Brother Ulrich invited Duff to go with him into the more expensive store across the street. And upon entering the store, he got him a suit and an overcoat, even against your father's protesting this act of kindness. But he finally relented and gratefully thanked him. Then Brother Ulrich said to him, "Let me tell you why this privilege means so much to me. I came to this country as an immigrant boy of 14. I didn't speak English, had no money, no job, and no friends. Someone sent me to Stanley Hanks, which is your grandfather, saying, "He takes in strays. Your father found me a job, brought blankets so I could sleep on a couch in his office, and brought food for me until I could buy my own. I have been waiting a long time to tell that story to Stanley Hank's son and share a little of the bread your sainted father cast upon the waters for me many, many years ago." I found that incredibly moving when I read that and wondered, how do you think this experience influenced your father? Because I think that he had many experiences like that.
Wow. Not interested in crying on the air, but well, the word that was used there was strays. Stanley took in strays. My dad took in strays. And I think probably the most documented, every Christmas Eve, long after we were all married, my four sisters and I, we would show up at mom and dad's house and there would be strays. There would be two missionaries, you know, from Russia. There would be a young pregnant girl. There would be, I mean, I just go through the years in my mind, there would be some African immigrants. And so he lived his life, really. My dad really loved Matthew 25. And Matthew 25 is the sheep and the goats and doing it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me, and going to prisons and the poor. And he really lived his life. He, you know, he had these big stages. I mean, he had 50 general conference talks and state conferences and all this stuff. He had the big stages, but he also had quiet moments. And I think that came from learning a little bit about his dad. He never knew his dad, and I obviously never knew my grandpa. He died 101 years ago. There is an interesting story, though. It's in the book. When my dad was three, so his dad had been gone a short while, Stanley showed up and stood at his son's bedside and talked to him about, you know, we don't really know the details, except for what Maud, my grandma, wrote down in a little journal, a little blue book I have, I treasure. And she basically just wrote down that, you know, your daddy came and talked to you about what important part of our lives you were going to be and maybe some future things that would happen to him. We don't have those details. But long time after, Dad wrote to Maud and said, "Hey, did this really happen? Or am I..." You know, we get more skeptical as we get more cynical as we get older. And she pulled out the blue book and they read it together. And I think that served as a basis really for his life. It wasn't the only thing. His sainted mother, we could talk about Maud for hours here. But I think that this concept of helping other people, Stanley didn't have two nickels to rub together most of the time. My dad, frankly, didn't have two nickels to rub together for right. most of the time. He was called so young. He'd never really practiced been in business or anything. So I think that it really it focused him on what he needed to become and how he needed to behave.
And that leads me to another question. So your father, Marion D. Hanks, was one of the youngest general authorities ever called in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And he was 31, if I remember right.
That's correct.
What things led up to this?
Well, this is a terrific story. He grew up in the Depression. He grew up on Capitol Hill, if you know Salt Lake. He had a widowed mother with six kids who never remarried. And she was one of our heroes as well. I mean, Maud was just incredible. But he went on a mission. At the end of his mission, a lot of his friends were dying in World War II, Pearl Harbor, et cetera. And so he actually tried to go home from his mission early. But his mission president convinced him that they needed him more in the northern states than they did on an aircraft carrier or something. As soon as he got home, he turned around and went and enlisted and went into the military. He was there during the time of the war. And the reason that I tell it a little bit earlier than you asked is because he was in Pearl Harbor for a little R&R. I think the ship was being refitted or something. So he went to church. And he went to church at the Waikiki Ward. And there was this blonde, gorgeous girl. And he wrote home and said, "You know, I haven't really thought much about girls the last 4 or 5 years, but I think she's cute. Maybe she'll like me." So what my mom tells, which is even funnier, is that her dad, my grandpa, leaned over and said, "That boy right there is going places." Anyway, fast forward, they both went to the University of Utah. My mother had to transfer from the University of Hawaii. And my dad wrote some funny things in the book about, I wonder why she chose, anyway. Why she chose the University of Utah. And obviously for him, then there's a whole nother story there. But anyway, they got married, and which I'd love to tell, but my dad was not as committal as he should have been. And so my mother went home after 4 years of college, or 3 years, and then my dad proposed over the telegram. I figured out, what have I lost? Anyway, all of that is background for, he graduated from law school, and he, by that time, was the assistant director of Temple Square, and he was a seminary teacher at West High, and he was an institute teacher at the University of Utah. So here he'd gone on a mission, and he'd been in the war. He met my mom, they got married, and he graduated from law school, but he didn't really want to be an attorney. He didn't want to practice law. So by that time, he was the assistant director of Temple Square with Richard L. Evans, who was at that time a member of the First Council of the 70, and doing the spoken word. He's probably the most famous LDS leader at that time, because he was doing the music and the spoken word, and it was going all over the world and so forth. So dad's teaching seminary, he's teaching institute, and he's being the assistant director, and he just decides, this is good, I'll just keep doing this. He gets a request, and he'd done things like this before. He became a very popular speaker in a way that doesn't really happen today. All over the valley here, it was mostly Salt Lake-centric. He was speaking 3 and 4 times a month at everything you can think of. These are all individual requests. Anyway, so he'd gotten quite a following. They invited him to speak at General, or to pray. They invited him to pray at General Conference. In those days, General Conference started on a Friday, so he gave the opening prayer of General Conference, went home, went back to life. Sunday morning, the phone rings, he picks it up, and the caller says, "This is David O. McKay. I'd like you to come down to my office if you can." And it would have been so polite. President McKay was an unbelievably courteous, decent, polite man. And so my dad said, he thought it was one of his friends pranking him or something. You know, he's like, "Sure it is." I don't know exactly what he said, but he always lamented that. Anyway, the caller said, "No, this really is David O. McKay." So dad went down, and this is in the book. I won't belabor it here, but it's a sweet experience. Obviously, one of the most sweet experiences of my dad's life. And the prophet called him to be in the First Council of 70 to replace Richard L. Evans, who was made an apostle.
Okay.
So just to put this in perspective, my dad's 31, my mom's 27. They've got 2 little kids, less than 3. They got really no money. And he's just been called to give his life, because at that time, you there was no emeritus. You retired by dying. And also every weekend of his life, with the exception 1 or 2 a year. So this is not a small ask. He walks from President McKay's office over to the Hotel Utah, and he calls my mother and says, "I think you need to get down here for this. I've been asked to take Richard L. Evans' place." My mom said to herself, "I wonder why he's making such a big deal. He's already running Temple Square, and Richard leaves. He can just keep running. Somewhere in that 25 minutes of her driving down there, I guess when she got down there and they met, I think her life was completely changed, because she thought it was just a Temple Square replacement, and no dad was. So he joined the quorum, First Council. He was 31. The oldest of the 7 members was 79. Can you imagine?
No.
For the next 40 years, that's what he did. But the whole experience for him was sweet. He remembers, he would share things with us, even that President McKay looked at him and said, and, you know, I'm sure he questioned. We all would. Was it what, me? And President McKay said, "The Lord has spoken," which I think was a sweet experience. So.
And so this was in the early 50s, right?
Yeah, it was in, October of 53.
Okay.
You know, he wrote some really special letters to my 2 oldest sisters that say, that I put them in the book too, I think. Not only did your mom and my life change today, but your lives changed also. Hmm. You won't have your daddy home, and it won't be normal in our home anymore. And people ask all the time, you know, he was never a bishop. He was never an Elders Quorum president. He was never a stake president. He'd been a seminary teacher. And suddenly there were only 7 presidents of 70 back then. So there's maybe 30 general authorities, as opposed to what do we have now, 600 or 7. I don't know the number, but this was a very small group, and they didn't really treat them any different. The apostles, there were 15 apostles and 7 70s. And so all of a sudden, And there are great stories there. I probably should shut up and let you talk. There's just like phenomenal stories where other people, you know, he's 31. When my son turned 31 6 years ago, I remember thinking, wow. One of his first state conference assignments was to the Pasadena Stake, where Howard W. Hunter was the stake president. A few years on, they go these massive mission tours, which would take weeks, and they'd interview every missionary, and so he gets called to do a mission tour to Houston, which he did mission tours all the time. This was his 17-year-old big brother, who had been a successful businessman and had a stake president of the Salt Lake Stake, and now here he's a mission president. I remember my dad saying, yeah, his little snot-nosed brother gets sent down to tell him how to do things. And I said, well, did you tell him? And he said, no. I just smiled and said, Lincoln, you know, I'm proud to be your little brother. And then they both wrote letters home to their mother, which is, again, it's just phenomenal to read, particularly Lincoln saying, telling Maude, his mother, this has been one of the best experiences of my life.
Oh.
It doesn't happen today, right? You very much. I mean, you go through these sort of these steps and chairs, it seems like, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that does sound really out of the blue.
So I have to share this one. This is...
Yes.
So in a letter that he got, I don't remember how many years, I think 15 years later, 10 or 15 years later, he gets this letter, and it's from one of his seminary students, and she was J. Reuben Clark's granddaughter. There were two granddaughters of J. Reuben Clark in the First Presidency, who were taking seminary classes from my dad. And so she writes this letter to him 15 years later that my grandpa, we went in to see him during General Conference like we always did. And he said, how do you feel about your seminary teacher becoming a general authority? And they, whatever word they'd use then, today we'd say, awesome, you know. And J. Reuben Clark said, it was the prayer that did it. So it was, I guess, him giving the opening prayer in General Conference somehow caught David O. McKay's eye, and
that was it. So when we started, Richard, you said that your dad was considered a point of hope and a beacon for those that were kind of on the fringes of LDS orthodoxy. Why do you think he was described that way?
Well, I began the preface of the book with the words, Marion D. Hanks was a believer. And that's really important, actually, to the rest of any question you could ask me. You know, we talk about social issues or the priesthood ban, or, I mean, we just go on and on for everything. That will inform everything that I possibly could say about him. He was a believer. And that, that interestingly enough, did not create any myths in his mind. It did not create an exaggeration of expectation. It did not, he allowed himself to just do. He once said, I'm going to get this quote wrong, but he once said that, or I think I wrote in the book, he knew very well that the church was led by imperfect men because he was one. And the authenticity of that approach to church leadership was honestly not generally followed. I just assume, I'm not taking shots at anybody today, but he just never, the pedestal, the people telling others not to ask questions or not to doubt. He thought the opposite. He thought questions were fabulous. He thought we should all study and understand. And because of those kinds of things, he was faced with many instances where, for lack of a better way of saying it, he didn't agree with some of the things that the church...
Maybe he was at odds.
He was. He just literally didn't agree. For example, we could talk again about the blacks and the priesthood. He just didn't believe that.
Right.
But, he could have done, I guess, a couple of things with that. He could have gone and made a big stink about it, but he was a believer. And he believed there was a prophet. And so consequently, he did everything he could to stop the priesthood ban. And that takes whole chapters, and we won't go into there today. But because he was willing to be this, the simplest thing, I said at his funeral, he would sometimes at General Conference just wear a gray suit. That seems like the simplest thing, but it's actually not. And I asked him once, are you doing that? Why are you doing that? Are you doing that to... you know, stick it in somebody's face or what? And he said, no, I'm trying to do that to let people in the church know that there are all kinds of people. I think today we might call it big tent Mormonism. I don't know who came up with that, people would flock to him. Those seeking mercy, those seeking hope, those seeking someone to listen to a progressive stance, and they're famous people about that. You can read all about Gene England. I mean, my dad is all through Gene England's books and journals, and he was a mentor, although there were times when they, when Gene was a burr under my dad's saddle, as it were. But he would just accept people for where they were. And then he didn't shy away from this being the Lord's church, or at least the Lord's teachings and truth. He also didn't make a big deal about the church and the priesthood and the gospel being the same thing. I don't know if he didn't believe that, but he certainly never taught that. He taught that the gospel of Jesus Christ is what we're here to do. It's what we're here to learn about. There happens to be this church. It's hopefully the true church. It is the true church, but it's a scaffolding around the gospel. All of those things I would argue with one more. He defended unpopular stances and unpopular people. And I'd say that those things that I mentioned, plus the last one, I think that just caused people to flock to him because they felt like he was someone who understood. At his funeral, my sister, Nancy, I don't remember which one of my sisters said, you could ask him the hard questions because you knew he had asked the hard questions, and had managed to keep his faith and grow his faith. There's so many stories here. He would get invited to go to Stanford and Berkeley and Harvard and kind of where the intellectual fringe, I don't know if that's the right word, but the intellectual students or leaders or, and he would just fly to Palo Alto and they'd borrow a chapel and he wouldn't give a talk or anything. He'd just sit down in the cultural hall with anybody who wanted to come, all the students from Berkeley and Stanford, they ask him all the hardest questions. And I've met those people all over the United States, all over the earth, actually. And including when we lived in Washington, D.C., one man, I don't have permission, but he said, this saved my life. This saved me and the church, your father's trips out there. Because we could see somebody who had asked all these same questions we had, was completely unafraid to say, I don't know. I mean, my dad used to always say, it's good enough for Alma, it's good enough for me. He'd just say, I don't know. He wouldn't pretend to have some doctrinal insight that was beyond what had been revealed to the prophets.
So do you think your dad was a bit of a rebel?
Yeah.
Would he have considered, did you consider him that?
A great question. I don't think he considered himself that because it can be a pejorative term. I think rebel requires a sort of an open resistance and an intention. And I never saw any intention in him to rebel. I saw significant disagreements from people that he adored. I mean, some of his colleagues and peers who he was really tight with, but one of them in particular, one named here, got up at BYU and said, I don't remember the exact words, but basically, here are seven things you can't believe unless you're an idiot. And I think that's not the word he used, but it was a brutal word. And, no evolution, no progression between kingdoms. Then he later came back and said, you can't worship Jesus. And my dad just patently disagreed with all of these things. I mean, he said, the brethren have never said of anything about evolution. They've never said anything about progression between, and in fact, Brigham Young and Orson Pratt, went at each other. And Jesus is who the scriptures tell us over and over again to worship. So I think that I didn't write this in the book, but I thought about it a lot since. He took his authority, kind of an interesting sentence, but he took his authority from a living prophet, which is what I think section 28 says, one living prophet, and the scriptures, and the Savior, therefore. And that's where he took his authority. And so when people went to a different place, he was not willing to just sit back and accept. So I give you just a quick insight to why that was. I thought a lot about that, and I wrote about this in the book. David O. McKay sent him in 1962 to clean up, David O. McKay's words, not mine, the mess that was the baseball baptisms in England. And that's a long story, but basically things had gotten out of control. There were contests and games. And so Dad went over there, and it was a very stressful time because there were some brethren, some of the apostles, for example, who liked the numbers coming in. And therefore, we're not happy with the numbers falling. When my dad went there, he just stopped everything.
And when you say numbers, Richard, you're meaning the baptism numbers.
Yeah. And way out of line. I mean, just completely just gone crazy. I mean, that's for another time. So he was sent over by the prophet to do one thing. And then some of the apostles at the same time and his own peers in the 70 were not happy with the reduction in numbers, despite the fact that the activity in the church was skyrocketing. Anyway, that's the preface. So he comes home and he reports, and he's done with that part of his life. And David McKay calls him down to his office and lays his hands on his head and said, "I'm going to give you a blessing. Dad didn't ask for it. And in that blessing, I wish we had it. We don't. Certain promises were made. But the most important sentence maybe of my dad's life was given. And the sentence he said was, let your voice be heard. Even in opposition to the status quo, or accepted norms." And I think that gave my dad confidence that maybe when others were insistent on punishment, he was insistent on mercy. He certainly was never accused of being a sycophant. He wasn't a yes man to sort of anybody. And he certainly wasn't diplomatic at times. And yet, on the other hand, he was loving and giving, and people just flocked to him, particularly those who didn't see the gospel as, cut and dried as maybe others.
Yeah, you could see that in the early part of the book where he was standing up to people during his military service.
Yeah.
And also to his mission president, Leo J. Muir, when he's kind of getting called out and he doesn't agree with the mission president's stance. I thought that was interesting that he was willing to, write a letter to his mission president and kind of disagree with him. I think that kind of shows early on that he was kind of his own person from an early age.
Yeah, and he was kind of fearless of the consequences. I mean, the consequences, if we didn't all believe or that the Lord guides his church, we might be carried away to the questioning of how much involvement human beings' feelings are. I decided in the book to just address that head on. I think I wrote it's not a chapter, I think a section called "Why Was He Never Called as an Apostle?" And and I'm not going to necessarily get into the details of that here, but clearly it cost him when he went up against certain individuals and church leaders back. This is early, right? This is in the 50s and the 60s, who just he thought were not necessarily. It wasn't like my way or the highway. He always had the scriptures as his base. That's why I started with that. He took his authority from what the Savior taught. I mean, for example, the Savior taught about the lost coin, the lost sheep, and the prodigal son. And Jesus sat there when a woman caught in adultery is brought to him, and he's writing in the sand. And he says, "Go thy way and sin no more." He doesn't say, "Go thy way and don't eat the sacrament, and I'm going to excommunicate you for 6.5 years. And it was just not... He just couldn't find it. And those are kind of harsh examples maybe, but there's hundreds of examples like that. And having said that, I don't know that the church members knew all this was going on behind the scenes. I mean, he was upbeat, positive, spoke of the Savior, always. Probably the two main talks of subjects of his talks in General Conference are service and the Savior, really. So I don't think he was attempting to be a rebel. I think it just sort of happened based upon his patriarchal blessing said almost the exact same words, you know, speak up. So he did.
So, Rich, it looks like you had so many great primary sources for this book. Where are you getting all of your sources and what records did you have to kind of curate?
Well, the bad news is that he became emeritus in 92. And that's 32 years ago. So the bad news is that everybody I wanted to interview is dead, just to put a fine point on it, or a very elderly, in their late 80s. I mean, that was a problem. His secretary, his executive assistant, we call now Phyllis, who's basically a part of our family. She kept everything. I mean, there must be 10,000 letters I read through. So still a primary source, really. I mean, it's a letter between two people. Either he wrote it or they wrote it. And I have all that. And then I have all his journals. And he was sporadic. He was a very good diarist, I guess they call it. But he, you know, he didn't write anything down almost at all in England during those 2 years because he was just, you know, running like crazy. But those were my primary sources. I did get to interview some folks. Jeff Elder Holland is still alive, and Elder Cook is still alive, and Marlon Jensen is even emeritus is still around. And so I did my best at some of his missionaries. Dick Whitehead is still around. Of course, most of them are in their 70s or late 70s and 80s. And then me, to be honest, my sisters, our little family, the five of us and our spouses, we all have memories. I did my best to grab as much as I could. All of those sources I gave, I just mentioned, all of them our family gave to the church. So they're all in the church history library. People can, if they want to go get even deeper, they can certainly do that. That's how we got where we are.
So that's just a lot of information to go through.
Yeah, it was.
That's just daunting.
I mean, the book came out at 610 pages, right? So
right.
This is And I've been assisted in seeing that might be too long by a few people, but who are particularly, you know, interested. When I first finished the first draft, it was 1,500 pages.
Holy cow!
And I thought at that point I had gotten rid of all the fluff. I mean, no fluff, straight. and yet,
yeah, editing comes in, right?
Yeah, you have to kill a lot of things that you want to keep, and that's, I guess, natural.
Well, Rich, kind of jumping back a little bit here. So your dad was raised by a single mom. So his father died of an appendicitis when he was only 2 years old. How did your dad talk about his father and the absence of a father in the home, if he did? And how do you think this affected the way he parented and also served?
Well, those are okay. I'll tack those separately. He lost his dad when he was two and he didn't really know him. And his only recollection was when they carried the body away. They brought him home from the hospital. I don't remember all the details, but he had that memory. And then his main memory was when his dad came and stood at his bed when he was 3 years old and visited with him. So he didn't know his dad, but he read and he saw and he watched his saintly mother. Maud, I did get to know a little bit. I was seven when she passed away, but she was a force. If I had to think about that question that you just gave, I would say, I think on the widowed mother's side that, I'm trying to think of the right words here. I think that gave him an incredible affinity for the non-traditional Mormon or non-traditional member of the church. I mean, he watched his mother, you know, six that lived, raise themselves. She raised their family. And,
right.
And I think I never really thought about this. I think that gave him a real insight into singles, for example. I never could figure out why were you so interested in singles. I mean, he, I don't know if you know this, but he helped, well, not helped, but he was there when the singles student wards were created in the 50s, I think it was. And clearly when the whole YSA program as it is today, not all of it, but the genesis of YSA wards, that all is from Marion D. Hanks and the committee, including Jeff Holland at the time. And so he just had this affinity for the non-standard, the non-traditional LDS person. Widows, fought for widows, did not like what was happening in the temple for widows. There were these rules about, I don't have them in front of me, but about who could get the ceiling canceled and who couldn't, and the men and the women. And he just didn't like it, to be honest. But it just gave him this, I guess empathy is the right word, for singles and for those who had committed sin and so forth. And so, you know, his mother, get this, his mother was a Ward Relief Society president for just an incredible amount of time. I don't remember the number of years. Then she became the Stake Relief Society president for like 7 or 8 or 10 years. And all this while, they don't have two nickels to rub together. And there's great stories, and I'm going to mess it up. I don't want to mess up his words, but they're just great stories that are basically like, wait a minute, who are these poor? Aren't we poor? You know? And
right.
I think the story, and I haven't looked it up recently, but I think it says there's a whole bunch of loaves of bread on the table. And then Maud gives him a dollar and says, go down to the store and get a loaf of bread. And my dad was, I guess, being a little snippy. And he said, what about all those? Can we just have a bite of that? And she would say, no, that's for the Relief Society, the sisters, the poor people in our ward. And my dad would say, aren't we the poor? I mean, it just gave him, I don't know if I'm even answering the question yet, but it gave him this feeling for poor people, people in prison. And each of these things that are in Matthew 25, he didn't just talk about. He went and did, you know? Sometimes annoyingly so for a little boy. And I'm, I don't know, 12 years old, and we go out and we're shoveling the walks on Butler Ave. And he'd say, why don't we do our neighbors? You know, and I'd say, why don't we not? And we'd go shovel all the walks, and we did. I mean, it was just... I doubt anybody will ask this. I doubt you won't ask me this question. So I just insert one of my very favorite stories. This is a story I was involved with all the time. But I'll just give two great examples. One, we're walking down the street. I'm maybe 10 or 11, and we're in front of ZCMI. And in those days, everybody knew who Marion D. Hanks was. I mean, we couldn't walk 5 inches without somebody. And we were walking. I'd sometimes walk behind him. And he would walk, I never forget, he'd walk up to an older lady or two elderly ladies, and he'd put his hands in theirs from behind, in their crux of their arm. And then he would say, pardon me, I'm feeling kind of shaky today. Would you help me across the street? And then they invariably look up and say, oh, Brother Hanks. And then another really sort of another poignant, I guess I'm off the rails here, but another really poignant story. When I was 16, he took me with him to Orlando to BYU in a bowl game. I think the Tangerine Bowl. And in those days, there was no loges or whatever they're called. There were no press box things. And so here we were in the sort of visiting dignitary party, and you had Spencer Kimball, the prophet, and you had general authorities. You had my dad and BYU administrators and blah, blah, blah. And we went to the football game, and they didn't even have a place for Spencer Kimball, who's this elderly prophet. And so dad said, "You come on, Rich, we're going to sit behind President Kimball." And we went back, and he had President Kimball lean back on his knees. There were no backs to these chairs, just, you know, benches. And he said, "I'll do the first half and you do the second." And there wasn't a big fanfare, and that story's not written down anywhere, but in my brain. But that's how he was. I'm kind of way off the subject, but that he learned all of that, I would suggest, from his mother. And again, I don't want to give the impression that she wasn't, she was a force. I mean, she was in political. She was, they had all these political offices in the neighborhoods. She was just, she had grit, and she raised these kids by herself, and they all took turn helping to pay.
Yeah, I love that about the book. I was so touched by how they all looked out for each other and pitched in and took care of each other. It was very moving, you know, and I think readers will really just love seeing that glimpse. And your dad lived through so much history, you know, World War II and Pearl Harbor and just all of it. There's so many.
You know, another a quick insert. He was, his ship, oh shucks, I can't remember what it was called, but it was turned around from Pearl Harbor, and he was on his way to Tokyo for the invasion. Some people don't know this, that the bombs were created separately. I'm not a historian here, but the bombs were created separately. But the whole like fleet was on their way to land in Tokyo and to come ashore and win the war. And there's a good chance I wouldn't be here, or at least in my current form, I suppose. And so, you know, the bombs were dropped and they all turned around and, you know, came back towards Pearl Harbor. But things like that, the things that he saw were just, you know, nuts, really. Crazy.
So, Rich, getting close to wrapping up here, the Salt Lake Tribune called your dad the poet soul of the church.
Yeah.
Do you know why? And I know he wrote a hymn that's in the hymn book, but were there other reasons why he was called that?
Yeah, he was a great poet, but I didn't write the story, but I'm pretty sure that despite the fact that he was a fabulous writer and speaker, I think what they're suggesting is that he had an emotional component that was maybe not as sterile, for lack of a better, or what's the right word? I mean, he was brilliant. Don't get me wrong. I mean, he was as smart as a man as I ever met. And I've been around some smart men. And women. He had this emotional component, this spiritual component, this gospel component. And there's so many examples. I'm just sitting here searching in my brain for trying to. The church has recently moved the entire temple ceremony towards the Savior. Way, way more than it was even a year ago, maybe 2 years ago. And I assume some members, some listeners will know that, and maybe others won't. He was there 50 years ago, 60 years ago. Used to say, the temple is about the path of the Savior. It's not about a continual dissection of the endowment. You know, I have people say, well, I learn something every time I go to the temple. And they'll say, well, yeah, well, these are the five covenants. And it's all sort of cut and dried. And he was a poet. And he was, again, in addition to the literal meaning of the term poet, he was the merciful believer in the Savior's teaching. He believed that the Savior's teachings were about mercy. And he loved, for example, John 3:16, right? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, whosoever believeth in him should never perish. But he made a big deal in our family. We had to memorize John 3:17. And John 3:17 is not as well known. You don't see it at NFL football games on signs like you do John 3. For God sent not his son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him may be saved. And so that's a great... I can't think of a better example than that. It wasn't just enough to teach and preach the Savior. It was to make sure we knew that God didn't send Jesus down here to punish us. He's not a punishing God. He's not a catcher God. He is a saving God. And, Patrick Kiernan gave this great talk at General Conference, and he said, you know, I don't remember the exact words, but God is, in constant attempt to bring us home. That's what Dad taught. He taught that he just loved the scriptures and he loved the gospel. And in his mind, that's what was important. And so he would say things like souls over statistics as it relates to baptisms, for example, or as it relates to our growth in life, that there's this eternal progression. Those are all things that I think would be under the umbrella of what maybe was meant by the person that said that.
I like that. And I like one of the stories is him giving a talk about how everyone should read poetry.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like that. I was like, that's funny.
While he was in college, just real quick, he'd go down to this place called the Rainbow Rendezvous, which is basically, I guess, a big pub. All right. Or maybe it was a restaurant. I don't know what it was. Maybe some of the people that were around will tell us. But he was a bouncer at the Rainbow Rendezvous. By the end of the night, he's bouncing out drunk kids he recognized from the University of Utah. Then he would walk home and memorize 50 lines of Shakespeare. So, I mean, he was the poet soul of the church, I guess.
Rich, in conclusion, who do you hope will read this book besides, I mean, we know your family is going to love it, but you know, who else do you hope will read this? And you touched on it a little bit at the beginning.
Again, primarily my family and our grandkids, but secondarily, I would be delighted to have the people that flocked to him then. I'd love to have their grandchildren see this life that was really unusual. I mean, when I say that, it's not starry-eyed son. He was unusual. I'd love to see people with faith crisis read it. I'd love to see people that remembered his voice of hope. I'd love to see progressives in the church read it. I'd love to see the general authorities, read it. And much of what I've said here, and even in the book, the church has moved drastically to some of these directions. In these directions, things he believed in 50 years ago. I'm not trying to give him credit for everything, but he was just so unusual that he didn't like church courts being called church courts. He didn't like holding somebody out from getting their, they had to wait certain many years to get their priesthood back and these kind of things. He just believed in mercy and love. And so I think that would be a helpful thing sort of for all of us. Again, most of his ministry in life was, I don't believe, coming out of his brain. I think it was coming out of the scriptures that informed his love of the gospel and of people.
I love that, Richard. And I think that's a good reason to write a book. Richard, thank you so much for being on our podcast today. And listeners, you can find To Be a Friend to Christ, The Life of Marion D. Hanks at your favorite bookstore and online and learn more about the life of this really amazing human.